All right, well, as I learned from Smokey and the Bandit as a youth, we have a long way to go and a short time to get there. So we have two sessions tonight. And for those of you who were not able to make the Joe Rigney session a couple weeks ago, the website there on the bottom, you can go and listen to that audio, or even if you did go to the Rigney seminar, if you go to that website, go to the bottom of the page, a lot of our men's courses are there. And the Rigney one would be the most recent. It's definitely worth a listen, but you don't have to have been at Rigney to benefit from tonight. But we did very much design this as a follow-up to the Leadership and Emotional Sabotage seminar. So, you are the head. Rigney was very clear about that. Not that you should be the head, you are the head. And so what does headship look like as men, and what about our world makes headship so very challenging? And so we're going to have two sessions tonight, Lord willing. We're going to answer those questions in reverse order. And so the first session is going to be Know Your Battleground, and then the second will be Lead Your People. God put men into the world for dominion. We're here to work and keep God's creation in communion with Him, which means we're here to do good works to glorify our Father. And central to those good works is the role of dominion and rule that God has given to us. And men and women both play crucial roles in that dominion, but not identical roles. We are not interchangeable, which is a radical and countercultural message in our day. But we are not interchangeable with women, and we are not defective women. We are men. And God has called us to lead. The world has always been and will always be built by men. That's just reality. Even in our day, we're reaping the fruit of godly men who built this nation and built the West. Not perfect men, but God-fearing men, strong men. But the 20th century brought massive changes to Christian Europe especially, and then to America. If you think about two world wars, and the deaths of millions of young men in Europe, it's hard to calculate the effect of that. Millions and millions of young men in Europe killed in two world wars. Many of those men were leaders in their community, future husbands, future rulers. And then you have the overthrow of centuries of traditional rule in kings and czars. Probably the biggest factor, and the one we'll spend most of our time on in this first session, is a massive rise in the political power of women. It's hard to overemphasize the effect that has had in our world. And then increasing attacks in the West against God and against the Christian faith at the most basic levels. That's the world that we've been born into and grown up in. And so tonight we're going to look briefly at the situation we're in and what we can do about it. And so this first session is going to be a little bigger, a broader look at problems at a society-wide level. It's not so you can complain. It's not so you can feel oppressed and sorry for yourself. It's not so you can carry a critique of women, because that's not the issue. But it's to help us to understand where we are, what we're facing, and what we need to do about it. And then we'll talk about how to actually do it. And so the thesis for this first session is that Christian men should change the world through godly rule. That's what we're looking at in this first session. Christian men should change the world through godly rule. And that was true in the Edenic world, in the garden. You think about it. When God made everything, He made the world. Within the world, there was a place called Eden. Within Eden, there was a garden. Adam was created outside of the garden. And then Genesis 2:15 tells us God put him in the garden to work it and to keep it. And so God called Adam to change the world through godly rule, to take the order and beauty of the garden and expand it, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and exercise dominion. That was the call in Eden. And so Adam was supposed to develop and expand and fill and strengthen, and crucially, to protect that garden. That's the keep element, and that's where he failed. And so for us who've never experienced that world, we're in the fallen world. We have all those same responsibilities, plus resisting and redeeming and fighting and winning. And so the call on us remains the same as what you see in Genesis 1 and 2. We're to work and keep God's creation in communion with Him. That's what we're here for. Now, we need to, in our county especially, we need to recognize that the Anabaptists represent a long-standing tradition in Christianity of an emphasis, really an overemphasis on otherworldliness, that we're citizens of a heavenly kingdom, and so we don't get too entangled in earthly affairs. And what's happened is, in church history, as this emphasis on a certain understanding of grace and the new covenant has led to a loss of the category of nature. It's almost like the Bible begins at Matthew 1, and that what we learn in Genesis doesn't apply, and that is how we have trans today. Because transsexualism is kind of the height, transgenderism is the height of saying there is no nature. There's nothing that's an original design. There's nothing given in God's world. Everything is free to be made however we want it to be made. There's been an abandonment of human nature in the West. And so that means that men especially face two temptations. And so if you look at that, there should be a line across there. I don't know if it's on your page or not, but there's a scope. The temptation to the left of that scale is abdication or passivity. You can write that as the header on the left side. Abdication or passivity, and under that you could write soft or effeminate. That's one temptation for men, is to back off from responsibility and be soft, to not be men. And that kind of masculinity is the kind that blames others for our problem. Right? That's Adam saying, it's the woman that you gave me. She gave it to me and I ate. It's the passive masculinity that resents the sacrifices and burdens of rule, that is anxious and fearful, and that produces a crippling uncertainty in the people that should be led by that man. That's one form of disordered masculinity. At the other end is harshness and abuse. So you have abdication and passivity, you have harshness and abuse, and under that you could write the word brittle. So you have soft masculinity, you have brittle masculinity. You have the effeminate, you have the tyrant. And that kind of masculinity is hypersensitive to disrespect. No man likes disrespect. But the tyrant is hypersensitive to disrespect. He resents risk and challenge. He's reactive and explosive. And what he produces through his leadership is intimidated surrender in most, and then occasionally a revolt when some rise up against him. And in between those poles is godly rule. That's the headline. And godly rule is both gentle and strong. Gentleness is a fruit of the Spirit. And so if you're just weak, you're not gentle, right? Gentleness is constrained strength. Have you ever seen a man hold a newborn baby? Or have you been, you go in the hospital, your baby's born. What is he? He holds it like this, right? Because this thing is so tiny, and it looks like you could, and he could crush it. But his strength is restrained. He's being gentle because of his strength. He doesn't want to harm the child, right? And so godly rule, godly masculinity is both gentle and strong. And so godly rule is the responsible, persistent work of exercising dominion in God's world. That's what the Lord calls us to. And so to understand what it means to lead directively, to rule in a godly way, there's two questions we have to answer. The first is the what question. What has the Lord entrusted to me? What has the Lord entrusted to me? And for you boys, especially who are growing up, there's another question you can ask related to that, which is, what would the Lord entrust to me? So you're not a husband yet, you're not a father yet, you're not a business owner, you're not a community leader, you're not a church leader yet, but that's what you should be aiming for. What would the Lord entrust to me? And actually, that's a question that should apply to every man, because if you are exercising godly responsibility well, do you know what you get? More responsibility. More is entrusted to you. And that's so central to how we grow as men, is stepping into that kind of responsibility. So what has the Lord entrusted to me? What would the Lord entrust to me? The second question is the how question. How am I to improve and defend what the Lord has entrusted to me? How am I to work and keep it? How am I to improve and defend? Okay? So that's a very basic, quick outline of godly rule. And so we need to look at what's the battleground of godly rule in our day, in our context. What are we actually facing as a challenge to us doing those things as men? And there's a quote, you'll often see this attributed to Martin Luther. And Luther didn't say it or write it. It's from a historical novel, and Luther's a character in the novel, and it's the sort of thing Luther would say, which is why it's attributed to him, but it's a great quote. It says, it is the truth which is assailed, attacked in any age, which tests our fidelity. It's to confess we are called, not merely to profess. If I profess with the loudest voice and the clearest exposition every portion of the truth of God, except precisely that little point which the world and the devil are at that moment attacking, I am not confessing Christ, however boldly I may be professing Christianity. Where the battle rages, the loyalty of the soldier is proved. And to be steady on all the battlefields besides is mere flight and disgrace to him if he flinches at that one point. So where is the world attacking God's design, and especially God's design for masculinity? And we think that that point of attack in our day is anthropology. It's the doctrine of man. It's what is humanity, and that includes things like male and female. It includes things like sexuality, evolution versus creation. It includes things like work. Is work good? Is work what we designed for? Is it just something that we have to do begrudgingly so we can focus on recreation? Includes the family and the state. All of those things relate to your anthropology. And that is exactly where the battle is raging, which is an unusual battle. Christendom had such a transforming influence on Europe and the West that the values of the Roman Empire were transformed to human values that glorify God. And so we're not dealing with merely a pagan view, we're dealing with a pagan post-Christian view of human nature. I read an article recently by a man, I think he's British, named Rhys Laverty, and he wrote, "We no longer live in a world which simply hates grace. As Christians, we're used to that idea that, yeah, I'm a Christian, I'm a disciple of Christ. Oh, well, good, I hate you because I hate Jesus. Okay, we got that, we've budgeted for that. But we don't live in a world that simply hates grace. We live in a world which hates nature. And understanding this fact is one of the most urgent priorities in Christian discipleship today." And the title of his article is very telling. What did you plan to be hated for? Did you plan to be hated for embracing nature as God designs? The world hates God's design. The world hates the givenness of things. And so we're going to talk about that. The primary culprit of that is feminism. So we're going to talk about feminism a good bit. I want to note at the outset, and I want to be really clear, this is not femininity, it's feminism. Femininity is a glorious good. Women are a glorious good from God that we should be grateful for, but feminism hates femininity, and we'll talk about that. And the rallying cry of feminism is equality, whatever that means, and I don't say that dismissively, that is literally how they function. Equality is a constantly moving target. Right? We need equality here. Well, no, that's not enough. Okay, we need equality there. No, that's not enough. Right? Which means that they always have a gripe and something that they can try and hold over men to leverage us to bow to their demands. Okay. One of the most famous feminists, Simone de Beauvoir, wrote The Second Sex, and she wrote, "Woman has always been, if not man's slave, at least his vassal. The two sexes have never divided up the world equally." That is the feminist complaint. So feminism is a demonic ideology built upon the resentment of the order of creation. Feminism despises the order of creation, beginning with God, he's at the top, and then all the order downstream from that. And it seeks to liberate women from the burdens of femininity as they understand it, especially dependence and submission. So if you want to understand feminism, you have to understand they hate order, and they see liberation as an escape from dependence and submission, and especially as that's expressed in their bodies, which we'll talk about. But there's been many goals of feminists through the years. I should be clear at the outset, too. It's common to say, well, you know, the first wave of feminism, that was pretty good. It wasn't. It wasn't. Did feminists have valid complaints? They absolutely did. Drunkenness was a massive problem in 19th century America. Prohibition passed because drunkenness was such a problem. But feminists were from the outset wicked and against God. They wanted to redefine the Trinity. It's too masculine. They wanted father, mother, and child. They wrote the woman's Bible. Eve became the heroine because she stood up for her rights and defied the patriarchy. Okay, so there's never been a good wave of feminism. It's always been godless, even where they did have some valid critiques. And so here's four primary values that have been pretty consistent. There were more than this, but the first and most pressing one was the vote. They wanted the right to vote because they wanted to gain independent political power. And I don't know if we realize how recent this is in human history, but the first nation to give women the right to vote was New Zealand in 1893. It's only 133 years ago. Okay? Now, I was a public school kid, so I was always taught that this is just one of the great milestones in the march of human progress, that women got the right to vote, because they were finally being liberated from the oppression and shackles that they had lived in throughout all of human history. But the aim of the feminists was to liberate women from dependence and submission. Household voting before that was not about oppressing women. It was about men taking responsibility for everyone in their household. They weren't voting their own selfish, I mean, of course some sinful men were, but the good and godly men were not voting their own sinful, selfish interests. They were voting for the good of their household. And the people who campaigned the most against women's suffrage were godly women saying, I don't want this because I would just vote with my husband. It's the ungodly women who are trying to advance a destructive agenda. This will liberate women from the protection of men. Men will not feel the duty to protect us anymore. And they were right. Okay, so the vote was a huge one. Birth control and abortion were the next frontier, because women have wombs and breasts and they experience the consequences of sexual intimacy in their bodies in ways that men do not. Right? A man and a woman can fornicate and the man seemingly doesn't have immediate consequences. There are consequences. But the woman bears the consequences immediately. All of a sudden there's a baby in her body that she has to deal with. And so birth control and abortion are the sacraments of feminism to liberate them from the tyranny of their body. And that is why it's my body, my choice. If you don't have a uterus, you don't get an opinion, right? Like this, there's a reason these mantras are so powerful and prevalent, because this is seen as oppression. That's why you have to understand, feminists hate femininity. They hate God's design. The third big one was divorce and redefining the family. And so, you know, and there were abusive husbands and there were drunkard husbands, but the difficulty of divorce was you had to prove it. It was a more or less biblical standard, adultery and abandonment. And if you couldn't prove it, you couldn't get out of this oppressive home. And so we can understand the challenge, right? So the answer was no-fault divorce. Anybody can leave marriage for any reason at any time. Ronald Reagan actually signed that into law in California in the 50s and started the great liberalizing trend of divorce in America. And the idea was this will free women from unhappy marriages and produce better marriages, much like gay marriage would produce better marriages, and to the same result. Okay. And then the fourth one was that women needed to have an independent income. They needed to have financial independence. They needed to get into the workplace and out of the home so that they're not dependent on men. Okay? Those four big goals of feminism have all been accomplished in a wildly successful way. They have been overwhelmingly successful. And evil men have been all too happy to cooperate with them. Because birth control means free love, baby, right? Sex without consequence. And what it's done is it has freed women from human nature, seemingly, and divine order, seemingly. But the result has not been an elevation in the status of women. The result has been incredibly destructive to women and to society.
The feminist dreams and promises of utopia by gaining their independence have not been realized because they're fighting against nature. They're fighting against God's order. Well, last fall, there was a woman named Helen Andrews, who's an American conservative political commentator and writer, and she gave a talk at the National Conservative Conference called Overcoming the Feminization of Culture. And it's worth a watch. It's 18 minutes. She's an interesting gal. It's very entertaining. She's kind of droll and just kind of no nonsense. But her point is that as women have ascended politically and gained increasing political power, it has changed our society at a bedrock level. And she has some very pithy statements, like feminization equals wokeness, which she defends. She says, look, feminization has produced wokeness because what it's doing is it's placing feminine values above the historical masculine leadership values. And so it's things like empathy, which is more feminine, over rationality, which is more masculine. It's safety, which is a very feminine concern, over risk, which is more masculine. It's conformity and agreeableness, the relational strengths of women, over competition and hierarchy. And that's what wokeness is. And so it's a contrast between the ethics of caring versus the ethics of justice. And she uses the illustration of the Kavanaugh hearings, if you remember, when Kavanaugh was nominated to be a Supreme Court justice, and these women came forward and accused him. And the media and other power brokers were trying to say, these accusations are so heinous, he's disqualified. And thankfully, some good men said, wait a second, these are serious accusations. We're going to take them seriously. What's your proof? You can't just say he abused me, he assaulted me. You have to have evidence. You have to establish this. This is a matter of justice. And the feminists are like, why are you talking about rules and facts and justice? Can't you see she's crying? Can't you see she's hurting? You're re-victimizing the victim, and that should be enough. And thankfully, they did not win that interaction, but it's a great expression of how feminism equals wokeness and that kind of ethics of justice. And so Andrews's prescription is we need to take the thumb off the scale. And by that, she means the anti-discrimination laws and the two-income trap that has said, you know, we have to have both husband and wife working in the workforce so that you can make it. And we need to have all these anti-discrimination laws to make sure things are fair. And she boiled it down to this slogan, just get rid of all the HR ladies. I don't know how many of you work in a significant corporate environment, but from 2000 to today, there's been a 500 or 600% increase in HR jobs. I don't know if you recognize that. In education, it's admin. Like, college costs have skyrocketed. The money's going to admin, not to teachers, not to facilities, admin. Why? Why has there been this? It's not that payroll's so much more complicated or benefits. It's because all these DEI initiatives and you know, sexual harassment training and all this other stuff that female values have been pushing into the workforce. And I think it's over 1 million HR jobs in America. 75% are held by women. 75%. So the women are kind of the police force of human resources in corporate America. And so she's saying if we would just get rid of all the HR ladies, that would solve a lot of our problems. Well, her talk went viral, as you might imagine. And so she wrote a follow-up article in Compact Magazine called The Great Feminization, and she's talking about the threat of wokeness at society's level. And there she wrote, cancel culture is simply what women do whenever there are enough of them in a given organizational field. Wokeness is simply feminine patterns of behavior applied to institutions where women were few in number until recently. And that's what we've seen across many industries. As women have begun to outnumber men in various capacities, wokeness, cancel culture, has grown exponentially. And so this is part of the payoff in that quote you can see. No civilization in human history has ever experimented with letting women control so many vital institutions of our society, from political parties to universities to our largest businesses. Even where women do not hold the top spots, women set the tone in these organizations, such that a male CEO must operate within the limits set by his human resources VP. We assume that these institutions will continue to function under these completely novel circumstances, but what are our grounds for that assumption? So we're running a societal level experiment with feminism, and we're seeing and experiencing the effects of it. As women enter various fields, men exit those fields. And so one of the illustrations she uses is psychology. The incoming class of psychologists is 20% men and 80% women. Men have evacuated psychology. And psychology has shifted increasingly to feminine values. In education, women earn 59% of bachelor's degrees, so 3-2. 63% of master's degrees, and 57% of PhDs. So women are dominating education, and women want to marry up. And that becomes challenging when there's more women holding these degrees than men. The current law school students are 56% women. Journalism is overwhelmingly going feminine. These are massive factors in our society. And so conservatives have addressed this in various ways. One of the terms that you may or may not have heard of is the term longhouse, and that's referring to a historical phenomenon in certain societies where there would be a long communal meeting house where the community could gather. And what made the longhouse distinctive is that it was run by the den mother. And it was ordered according to feminine priorities and sensibilities. And so a man who went by the name Lomez until he got doxxed, his name is Jonathan Kieperman, wrote an article for First Things where he said, more than anything, the longhouse refers to the remarkable overcorrection of the last two generations towards social norms centering feminine needs and feminine methods for controlling, directing, and modeling behavior. Okay, so this would be things like trigger warnings. We're going to talk about this might be a trigger warning. We're going to talk about this. Safe spaces. You know, after Trump won, law students at the University of Michigan had to go into safe spaces where they could pet puppies and color in coloring books because they were so traumatized that Hillary lost. Participation trophies, everybody's a winner. And of course, one of the preeminent ones is COVID, because what was the main driving emphasis in COVID? Safety. Safety. You have to mask, you have to distance, you have to stay home from work for safety. And if you didn't do those things, you were a threat and you hated people, right? You wanted people to die, and that's why you wouldn't do those things, okay? So feminine values have captured our society. The church has not been untouched by this. And one of the ways you see this in the church at large is that Christian piety has largely been equated with feminine virtues. So things like being quiet and agreeable and inoffensive or nice, what Vodi Bakum called the 11th commandment, thou shalt be nice, right? The height of Christian piety is niceness. And what that produces for men is a masculine inability, because men aren't able to be women, which means if feminine virtues are the paradigm of Christianity, then men aren't good Christians because they're not good women. Right? And they feel like, I'm just not very good. I'm too uncouth. I'm too rough. I'm too, you know, unmannered. You see that in the pastoral virtues. Pastors are supposed to be super nice guys that are just very agreeable, only have positive things to say. And as those values have been elevated, the question of women pastors has risen significantly. Because who's better at being women than women? Right? And if she has the gifts, how can you deny her the role? The SBC, which is the last major influential conservative Protestant denomination in America, is under significant attack over the issue of women's pastors, and they have had an extremely hard time shutting that down. There's thousands of SBC churches with women pastors. Right? And those are the arguments. Rick Warren made that argument. He was SBC. I don't know if you were aware of that or not. One of the ways that really plays out in the church is in things like conflict and debates, especially when it comes to issues of orthodoxy. And so the acceptable way of dealing with issues in the church is often indirect speech versus direct speech. It's consensus more than contest. It's relationship more than truth. And those are more feminine virtues. We face this in TFC. We had a task force put together an abuse document, and I was on the theology committee, and I read it, and it was terrible. And so in our group chat for our theology committee, I said, this is woke justice. And there was an elder who was so outraged with me. He couldn't believe I would say such a terrible thing about the efforts of fellow elders, right? And he's coming at me. He's a very nice guy, although it's always punch right, coddle left, right? I will be nice to those more liberal than me, but if you're more conservative than I am, I can come at you. And so he's coming at me. And I said, look, this is woke justice, right? And so he's all worked up. He's like, well, we need to talk on the phone. And I said, well, we're going to see each other in a couple weeks. Let's talk then. I'd rather have this conversation in person. Well, then he's outraged at that. I've never had a pastor refuse to have a phone call with me. And I wanted to say, well, you have now, but I didn't. I restrained myself. And I said, well, that's okay. We'll talk when we meet in person. And we did, and we talked it through. Right? But it was very interesting. He wasn't upset about the wokeness. He was upset that my tone wasn't soft enough, that it was too harsh and condemning. And by the grace of God, we did not adopt that document, although when it came up for our meeting, guys were trying to tweak it, and we're like, look, this is not a document that you can tweak. It needs to be scrapped and rewritten, which we did, and we have a much better document. But that kind of thing is very much at play in the church. Masculine speech is direct. It's clear. It's gracious. It's not a license to be a jerk. Okay? It's gracious, but it's truthful. It's uncompromising. And so masculine speech stands for truth in relationship. It doesn't sacrifice truth to preserve relationship. It says, yeah, I want to have this relationship. Let's unite around the truth so that we can relate and build together and do something good. Not, well, yeah, maybe we can soften this so that we can stay buddies. No, 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 no. No, no, no. That's not what we do. Okay. So, how are we doing for time? Let me give one more example. The Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them. It's one of the largest Reformed parachurch groups. They're actually headquartered in Lancaster. It used to be in Philly, and Lancaster's cheaper, so they moved up here. They have lots of conferences, podcasts, articles, books. They had a podcast called Mortification of Spin, and the hosts were Carl Truman, who's now at Grove City, but used to be at Westminster Seminary, and Todd Pruitt, who was a pastor in the Philly area, is now down in West Virginia. And they would talk about theological issues, cultural issues. Always interesting, didn't always agree, but worth a listen. Well, at a certain point, they decided to bring a woman on the podcast, and they didn't say why, but I'm pretty sure it was, we need to get a woman's perspective, and maybe we'll increase our audience with women. And so they brought on a woman named Amy Bird, who had written a book, The Housewife Theologian, Encouraging Women to Be Theologically Informed. And they started to platform her and to bring her to conferences. And she gained influence in the Reformed evangelical world. And then she wrote a book called Recovering from Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. And here's what she wrote. Christian men and women don't strive for so-called biblical masculinity or femininity, but Christ-likeness. Rather than striving to prove our sexuality, the tone of our sexuality will express itself as we do this. My contributions, my living and moving are distinctly feminine because I am a female. I do not need to do something a certain way to be feminine, such as receive my mail in a way that affirms the masculinity of the mailman. I simply am feminine because I am female. And Mark Jones, who's a PCA pastor, wrote a review of the book, and he said, Bird's contention that she doesn't need to act like a woman because she is a woman is sort of like a Christian saying, I don't need to act like a Christian because I am one. It's a nonsense statement, all right? There's no female way of doing things or male way of doing things. It's a category confusion. It's destructive. She's destroying nature. She's denying nature. But it is a very appealing message in our cultural context. We have to realize that. 80 years ago, C.S. Lewis was dealing with the same issue because the Anglican Church was seeking to make women into priests. And Lewis wrote, the innovators are really implying that sex is something superficial, irrelevant to the spiritual life. To say that men and women are equally eligible for a certain profession is to say that for the purposes of that profession, their sex is irrelevant. We are, within that context, treating both as neuters. And if you've been paying attention to the news, you know that the feminists won, and that the Church of England just enthroned, because they do actually crown her, the new Archbishop of Canterbury, who is Dame Sarah Mullally. They have a woman heading up the Church of England. They've conquered the church. So, let's look at some of the fruits of that at a societal level. First, let's look at the issue of political alignment. If you can bring up that chart, there we go. So, this is an analysis of political identity by sex and marital status. And so you can see that married men vote Republican at about 3-2. Married women vote at almost the same level. Unmarried men are a little over half that way, but unmarried women are 2-1 Democrat. Women raised under feminism have embraced the Democratic Party, and the Democratic Party has embraced them, and the priorities of the Democrat Party are very much oriented to disordered feminine values. Okay, that's one of the fruits of feminism. Related to that is the issue of mental health. And so the Pew Research Group did a survey in 2020, and they asked the question, has a doctor or other healthcare provider ever told you that you have a mental health condition? And they analyze this by all kinds of factors. And this chart is white liberal women, white moderates, and white conservatives. So it's just looking at white people right now. The blue is the women, the red is the men. And what you see is the more liberal you are, the higher the likelihood that you have a mental health diagnosis. And women, with one exception, one categorical exception, have a higher likelihood of mental health diagnosis. Why is that? I think it's because progressivism is contrary to nature. It's contrary to the order that God has designed. And so it just produces this incredible discomfort, this dis-ease with the world, right? They're going against God's design. Well, what else has feminism produced? Well, it's produced massive changes in the family, in the household structure. So this chart is from 1960 to 2023, so 63 years. If you look at the largest, in the kind of golden yellow, the largest component of households in the U.S. in 1960 were married parents, 44%. So almost half of the households in America were married parents. Well, what influence would that have on society and on politics and on education? You look now, that's 2.5 times fewer, 18%. That is a massive change in our societal structure. And right now, the percentage of American households who are married with no kids or single with no kids combined is 58.4%. So almost 60% of Americans do not have children in their household. Part of what that does is we've moved away from the family structure is it produces a massive reliance on the government to fulfill the role that the family was designed to fill. We look, you know, if there's a problem, what do people think? Somebody needs to write a law. That's the solution. The government will fix it. All right? The Affordable Care Act is going to make sure that everybody gets the care they need. And it's just one in a long line of moves to empower the government and disintegrate the family. One other marker of maturity. This is a chart marking the percent of 30-year-olds who are both married and homeowners from 1950 to basically today. In 1950, it was over 50% of American 30-year-olds. So for every two 30-year-olds you met on the street, one of them was married and owned a home. Now, I didn't own a home at 30, so the point of these things is not to critique us individually. It's to look at societal, okay? That is now less than 10%. That's a massive change in the structures of our society. And these are the fruits of feminism, not only, but it is a massive player. So feminism has fractured society. It's taught women to be more masculine, it's taught men to be more feminine, and it's taught the church to be more apologetic for everything. We're just sorry for everything, we messed it all up. So why do we raise these things? Well, it's because feminist values have captured our society. And as men, we need to stop cooperating with that and stand up and fight for righteousness. You need to have the right kind of righteous disagreeableness. And so let me give you an example. My son Josiah started wrestling last year as an eighth grader for Penn Manor. That's our district. Never wrestled before, other than jumping on me in bed when I'm trying to sleep, and wrestling his brothers, and then Joey, as Joey married in the family. But he goes and signs up for wrestling, and you know, it's your first year, and so there's a learning curve, right? But he worked hard. He worked really hard. He did great. And we go to one of the first tournaments at CV, and I didn't anticipate this. I probably should have. But there's hundreds of junior high boys wrestling on four mats, and there's dozens of junior high girls wrestling the boys on the four mats. And I'm watching these boys, and when they have to wrestle a girl, they're like, where do I put my hands, and I don't want to hurt her, and I don't want to be inappropriate, and right? And I start looking around, I'm like, where are the dads who are putting their girls out there? And where are the dads who are letting their sons wrestle the girls? And so Josiah, it wasn't an issue that day, I don't think. There weren't any girls in his rotation or whatever. But we went to the coach afterwards, and we said, look, we don't wrestle girls. There's two things I told him. We don't wrestle girls, and we don't wrestle on Sundays. Okay? From when my boys were born, I tell them, God made you strong, among other things, to protect the women in your life. Your mom and your sisters should never fear you. They should always feel safe and protected by you. God made you big and strong, in part, to protect them. So we're not going to go on a wrestling mat and try and beat a girl up. What are we talking about here? Right? And here's the thing, brothers. If the dads, as a whole, would say, my son's not going to wrestle a girl, guess what? There would be no girls and boys wrestling. And if the dads, as a whole, said, we're not going to do your camp or your tournament or whatever on Sunday, there would be no Sunday sports. So what does that mean? It means the dads as a whole are not doing that. They're not exercising godly rule, right? Whether it's passivity or it's probably mostly passivity. I don't think it's mostly tyranny, like, well, let's crush the women, right? There's some disordered masculinity that says, I want my girl to be tough and wrestle boys. Right? I want my girls to be tough and strong too, but as women, not as second-order boys. There are, I don't know, 10,000 things like that in our world. There are things like that in your areas of responsibility where you could stand up and say, no, we're not doing that anymore. Nope, we're not going along with that. Yep, and then if you have the opportunity to get some other dads and say, hey, dads, are you guys okay with this? You think this is good? Do you think it'd be better if this wasn't happening? Right? I'm not going to start a statewide initiative to get girls out of boys wrestling. I think that'd be great if somebody wants to do that. That's not, with my life and responsibilities right now, that's not where I'm at. I would gladly participate in it. But I am going to make sure that my son doesn't wrestle girls. Right? And there shouldn't even be a question. So things like that, you want to think through, where has the Lord given me an opportunity to produce godly change? And part of what Josiah's had opportunity, because his teammates say, why did you forfeit? And he says, we don't wrestle girls. And at the very least, they're saying, I respect that. Well, let me give you another example from that. At the end of the year, they had a massive tournament up in Reading. It's a great tournament. Reading has this cool gym. It's surround bleachers. It's recessed. And it's this massive tournament, hundreds of wrestlers. There's six mats in the main area. There's two other mats on another side. And this is, again, it's his first year. It's a two-day tournament. There's no expectation he's making the second day. Okay? But he goes, he wrestles hard, wins a match or two. Then he wrestles the number five guy. He loses. He should have won. He had him, right? So close, but he lost. No shame in that. So he has his first loss. He wrestled back, win, wrestle back, win, wrestle back, win. He made it to day two. Great accomplishment. We look at the schedule. Who's his first opponent on day two? A girl. He forfeits. Right? He has to forfeit the chance to advance at this prestigious tournament because he's not going to wrestle a girl. And I'm proud of him. It cost him. Right? He stood up for righteousness. There is a cost to this. Okay? But this is how we love our neighbors, actually. You understand when they say, you know, Christian nationalists, you just want to impose your values on people. Well, first of all, I don't own the label Christian nationalism. But second of all, yes, I do. I want to impose my values on you, and you want to impose your values on me. The difference is my values are good for everyone, and your values are leading to the destruction of society. Okay, so part of godly rule is imposing your values righteously and rightly understood on the people that the Lord entrusts to you. It's not a question of whether or not values are going to be imposed. That's what legislation is. It's which values and why and to what effect. And God put men in the world to change the world through godly rule. He's given you authority. He's given you power physically and in other ways to change the world for good. And so you look at the what the Lord has entrusted into you, and then you look at the why, how do I produce change here? How do I improve this? How do I defend that? And that's where there's lots of different answers for each of us in our relationships. And so as men, we need to recognize the challenge of the setting we're in. We live in a thoroughly feminized society. That's just the way it is. Lancaster is more protected from that than most, but it's not all that different. The public school system is thoroughly feminized. Public education as a whole is very hostile to masculinity because little boys don't sit still with their hands in their laps and act like girls. But that's the expectation. And so we have to drug them up to make sure they don't misbehave. So as men, we have to be willing to be righteously disagreeable, right? You have to be disagreeable toward evil, disagreeable towards unrighteousness, and you have to be willing to be slandered for it, because if you stand for truth, you will be slandered. I guarantee it. If and when you stand for truth, you will be slandered, if you haven't already. And it's actually a good way to evaluate. If there's no pushback to my leadership, then something's off. There's some way that I'm probably compromised with the world and I'm going along with worldly values because nobody has a problem with how I lead. Woke is not dead. The whole thing with Trump winning, no, it's not. It's reloading. It's obvious because it's so deeply entrenched in the structures of society. They're just biding their time until they get back in power. And so we need to act in the realms that the Lord has given us. We have to fear God more than men. And really, actually, I think for us as Christian men, you have to fear God more than women. Because men have a very hard time dealing with the displeasure of women. But if you're going to lead faithfully, if you're going to love your wife, you have to disappoint her at times. You have to say to her, no, dear, that's not okay. That's not what we're going to do. It's not okay for you to have that attitude or act that way. That's not righteous. And as the head, as your husband, I love you enough to tell you that. And here's the wonderful thing about Christian women. Because they love and fear the Lord, even if they don't like what you say in that moment, they will grow by God's grace and respond rightly, and they will respect you more. If you find that your wife doesn't respect you, there's a pretty good chance that part of the reason is that you don't stand up to her effectively and lovingly. right? Wilson has that phrase, if you won't stand up to her, she knows you won't stand up for her. Okay, there is a righteous way to displease your wife that's aimed at her good and God's glory. It's not just about your preference. So we have to embrace masculinity and masculine virtues as good so that we can rule wisely and well as men. And so let me leave you with this. What is the indispensable male virtue? This is one of my favorite memes on the internet. I think it's righteous stubbornness. Right? I love this billboard. It says, this year, thousands of men will die from stubbornness, and somebody spray painted, no, we won't. It's the perfect response. What are we talking about? Right? If we as Christian men stand on righteous and say, no, we won't. Are you kidding? We're not going along with that. That's wicked. That's destructive. That's not good for anybody. We're going to stand here with the Lord and his purposes. And if you hate me for it, okay. I don't want to be hated, but you got a budget for it. There should be a righteous stubbornness. One of my children said to me, Dad, you're such a brick wall, because I wasn't giving them what they wanted. I said, yeah, but a brick wall only hurts if you're running when you hit it, right? Because she was running. And it's, nope, I'm going to stand here with the Lord, with righteousness, because I love you, because I'm for you. And you can count on me because I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. I'm here. And I love you, and I'm for you. And yeah, that means I'm not going along with this, but it's because I love you, and I'm for you. There is a righteous stubbornness to godly masculinity. So don't be a jerk, don't be arrogant. Do be convictional. Do be courageous. Christian men should change the world through godly rule. Let's pray. Father, we thank you that you have given us your word. You've given us the church. And you call us as men to grow in our leadership, in our masculinity, that we could live for you and for your glory, and in that way be a force for good in your world. So Father, please keep us from self-pity and complaint. Give us conviction, give us courage, give us clarity so we can stand and be a force for good, and that others would see our love for you and one another and would glorify our Father in heaven. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.